Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
Okay, good evening everybody, and welcome to Great Controversies. So some of you from last year may recall that I like to play games with technology, and it's part of what keeps things interesting, especially in the classroom. And you're not obligated to participate, but if you're so inclined, it can further enrich our learning. This is a neat little tool that I have. It's been around for a while already, and it allows you to text your answer using a cell phone, and your answer will appear on the board. So I've, for example, attended conferences with a few thousand people in the room, and you want to know who you're sitting with, and the presenter can ask a question, how many people here are from Georgia? You text your answer, and you've got your data right there in front of you. So I don't know if you noticed, when I texted my answer, the blue bar filled up with its one answer, and if you were to text no, you'd get that bar would fill out. And here's the way it works, and again, under no obligation, but just in case you want to participate. What you would do is you would put this number in your address. That would be the number you're texting to. And depending if you wanted to answer yes, you would put that as your content of your message. If you wanted to answer no, you would put that as the content of your message. And aside from reminding everybody that we want to keep our phones on vibrate, this is a way for me to demonstrate this neat little program, and we're going to use it a little bit because especially for tonight's content, so much about our discussion this evening is going to be relevant to our daily lives. I'm sure that's the case in all of the discussions, but perhaps this controversy in particular is going on to this very day. You might have people sitting next to you have very different positions on this controversy. And the neat part about it is that regardless of where you stand on the controversy this evening, you're not outside of anybody's camp, which is fun. You can take both positions and daven in the same shul, marry each other's kids, eat from each other's tables. It's a fascinating discussion for that reason. So if you're so inclined and you're willing to share some of your own personal, not personal, but own opinions, we can use this tool to gather some data. So, and again, the way it works is this will be the recipient of your text message, and the message you will send will either be this number if you want to say yes, this number if you want to say no. Are there any questions about that?
Yes.
Go ahead.
What do you do if you don't text?
Oh, that's an excellent point. Thank you very much. If you don't text, which is not a bad habit to have, I'm going to ask that you participate. Raise your hands, share your opinions. This class, and as I'm sure you've noticed already, this is a fantastic group of individuals setting aside their time this evening to learn, to discuss things that are meaningful to the Jewish people. And the more that you can participate and share from your wisdom and your experience, the more the class will be rich. Doesn't matter if you text it or if you answer it. Any technical questions about actually using this program? Yes?
Wi-Fi.
You don't need Wi-Fi. It could just be a text message. If you want to do Wi-Fi, you can use a browser if you want. But this setup is just to use a text message. Okay. With that, we'll begin. Tonight's discussion is Kabbalist versus Rationalist. I'm Rabbi Asher Yablok. And this is the Shimon Shlomo and Margarita Vada Great Controversies in Jewish History on January 13th. I'm relatively new to this community. I've been here for about two and a half years. And this is the highlight, certainly for me, of this season, is having a chance to join together with you and learn a little bit. My major in Yeshiva University was Jewish History, and I took a great deal of interest in Jewish History. I liked it very much. It's a very exciting discipline, especially if you're living a Jewish lifestyle. And then I took a turn a little bit and got into rabbinics and studied in the Beit Midrash. learned for smicha, learned in kol a little bit, and took a more of a primary focus in education. And one of the reasons I did that was because, as fascinating as the study of Jewish history is, it's about Jews. And I wasn't prepared to spend a large enough amount of my time standing on the side and watching and observing. I wanted to be doing. And the more I was doing my research and writing about what this particular Jewish community was doing, what that individual thought, I realized I want to be a person that they write about. And I want to be a person who's living as a part of that Jewish community and doing. And so I got more interested in actual Torah study and Jewish education. The neat thing about this series, and most of what goes on in this room, is that you don't have to pick or choose. We're studying, and I'm sure you've learned over the past couple of years, you're studying things that took place historically, ideas that were held dear by people possibly 1,000 years ago, if not more, that are going on today, that affect our own lives, that influence the decisions we make all the time. And you don't have to make that decision, is this a discipline I want to study or not? You just get to do it. So I'm excited to be here. This tonight in particular, it's going to be a fascinating discussion. And I look forward to getting into the details with you. Let's try this out. First question for tonight. And you can jot down your answer on a piece of paper. You can raise your hand. Where does true knowledge come from? I gave you a multiple choice question. Does knowledge come from human discovery, research, observing things? Does it come from divine revelation? A message, a vision, a tradition from one person to the next? Or does it come from both? That's your easy out. And I'll give you a couple seconds to think about it. But I think our answers to these questions are going to put us in position to get right into the debate between mysticism and Kabbalah versus rationalism, logic, legal theory, and the two camps. If you're so inclined, you can text your answer. Somebody did. They're on the Divine Revelation team. We got one answer here. And the way to do that is to send to this number, send the answer that you like. While people are choosing to or not to text, anybody have an answer they want to share? Both? We have a lot of both? Excellent. Anybody not on the both camp aside from the two people who are on God's team? Yes. Yes.
What do you define as true knowledge?
Well, so I originally had just knowledge. And when I put true knowledge, what I meant to say is something that you believe to be not just seems like it is, but to the degree that you can, you know it to be true. And I know that that's hard, because who knows everything for sure, anything for sure? But, what's that?
Do you use proof?
I left that in part of the debate, but proof would put you in the human discovery camp. Because you're going to now present evidence that it's so, as opposed to simply saying, God told me, or somebody who spoke to God told me. And what's going through your minds right now is at the core of our debate between Kabbalists and rationalists. This is example number one. I'm hoping more than two people are interested, and just two people who took the time to text. It's taking time. Okay, that's good. That's question number one. We'll come back to these when we get to our discussion. Question number two for tonight. And you can, again, jot down your notes or text your answer. What do you do when someone you know is terminally ill? Do you daven? Do you seek a bracha or a segula from a miracle worker, a Hasidic rabbi, a Kabbalist, a great inspirational person in your life? I would put in there, do you run to a particular gravesite and pray? Choice number three, keep searching within the medical field, look for alternatives, consult other doctors, travel to some shady country that they'll do anything? Or are you going to do all of the above? We've got some all of the above. It looks like that one's on fire. And I'm going to turn to those non-texters again. In no discrimination. Yes.
For me, there's a difference between someone that I know who's terminally ill and someone very close to me.
Mm-hmm.
If it's really close to me, I'm going to do everything under the sun.
Sure.
If I have them.
In other words, you would advocate, get to the hospital, ask the doctors questions. If it's somebody you've never met, you heard overseas.
If it's someone further out,
mm-hmm.
or something like that. Then, yeah, I would certainly
doubt it.
I do.
Okay. Yes?
I think some of the questions they raise seem to board on both. Because we've been influenced by both.
Yes, that's where I'm headed. And that's why I think this is such a lively discussion. And what's going to be interesting is that I would like to argue that if you're a pure rationalist, you've got one answer to these questions. And if you're a pure Kabbalist or a mystic, you've got one answer to these questions. And what's neat for us, and I think neat about the controversies course, is that some of us are blends of both, share both, whether it's because you've got Hasidic tradition in you and Misnagdic tradition in you, whether it's because your own personal studies at times have led you to certain places, or whether there's certain influences in your life. So I was expecting a lot of all of the above. Did the person who said Davin, and you don't have to identify yourself, mean that exclusively by not choosing all of the above? That's the only choice left? Is there anybody who feels that way? Excellent. Sure. The answer here was that when you know someone who's terminal, which I'm assuming means the doctors have said we've done all we can do, that the solution is to pray. Ask God for mercy. We've unfortunately been in that situation from time to time. We've exhausted what we feel like is all of our options. So we daven and we pray. Excellent. Question number 3, just to get us focused on this debate. What is the point of mitzvot? What are we trying to accomplish? I didn't give you an all of the above here. Are we trying to better ourselves as humans, focus our morals, our ethics, develop high quality character, build a good world for people to live in, for kids to grow up in? Or are we looking to affect something in the spiritual realm, create angels, repair God's name, bring the Shekhinah in its glory somewhere here close by? And again, I forget about texting, although look, we got people on both sides here. Forget about texting if you want to just jot down your answer.
Why didn't you put all of the above?
Because I wanted to have a little bit of a controversy. That's the name of the course. So we've got answers on both sides. I'm sorry, the screen resolution, I was trying to work it out. It should tally it for us. But we've got multiple answers on both sides. Yes?
It's completely to affect change in the spiritual realm. That's our job, and that's what God has put us here for.
Excellent. So, number 2. Super. I think you're well supported by scholars throughout history and people living today. But this does inform your behavior. Anybody on the other team? I see that there are. Was there anybody who would have picked both by a show of hands if they could? So they don't necessarily seem mutually exclusive to those of us in the room. It seems like you can do both. You got to become a good person, like we say, you got to be a good Jew. And you hopefully can impact something in the spiritual world. But again, if you're a rationalist, I think you have one answer to this question. And if you're a Kabbalist, I think you have another. And my point with posing these questions was to get ourselves right there in the middle of this controversy. and show you how real it is and how it informs decisions that we make. Thank you for participating. Anybody have anything to add to this question or any of the other questions we raised? Because we will come back to them. But please, yes.
Aren't you saying that God made a mistake, or that God can be influenced, or God can be bought off in some way?
I might not have picked those terms. There are those who would there are those who would say that God has entered into a relationship with us and created opportunities for us to partner with Him. Some would say that's evidenced by things like Brit Milah, where God asked for us to participate in our own perfection with Him. But not exclusively, obviously. That's an example. So some would say God has given you free will to choose, to work with Him, to create a better world. I don't know if that means it's a deficiency. It's a choice, the way some would say He made. In Kabbalah, they would call that tzimtzum. He pulled away of Himself to give that opportunity. Now, the segula is an excellent option, an excellent discussion. Some will say, a segula doesn't have meaning unless it corresponds to something meaningful. Such that I was once at the table with a great rabbi, I won't tell you his name, and you'll understand why in a second, and it was a Sheva Brachos table. It was very festive. He was seated at the front of the table because he's a big rabbi, sitting in between the groom and the bride and their parents. And they made hamotzi, cut the bread, and the mother-in-law turns to the rabbi and says, "Ooh, pass me some of the challah. Isn't it a segula?" And I kid you not, the rabbi said, "It's a segula for putting on weight." In his mind, that's what corresponds to reality. But there are those who will say, you want something good in your life? You want to merit to get married? Have kids who get married? You go get a drink from that glass of wine. You go get a piece of that challah. And there are people who will do it. And I'm not passing judgment. This is a controversy. It's a difference of opinion. But it informs the way you live. And it's very real. And of course, it's okay to joke about challah. But like we said, when there's illness, you want to do everything you can. Some would even say, who cares what camp you're in? Make it work. Get the person better. So that's where we're at this evening. And I'm excited to talk about it a little bit with you tonight. We're going to start with the dual nature of man. You have on your sheets that I handed out to you, this should be the first one that doesn't look strange. And it's got a pasuk from Sefer Bereishis in Perek Beis, pasuk Zion, where God creates man. It says, "Vayitzer Hashem Elokim es Adam." Now this is Bereishis, so we could probably spend a whole night on each one of the words. But for now, God formed man, afar min ha'adama, from the dust of the earth, vayipach be'apav nishmas chayim, and he inhaled, or actually exhaled, into his nose, or mouth, his nostrils, nishmas chayim, the spirit of life. Vayihi Adam lenefesh chayan, man became a living being. Now, apart from our discussion about Kabbalists and rationalists, one of the great Hasidic masters writes, what does it mean that vayipach? When you blow something, it means you take something from deep down inside you. You have to have the breath inside you, and you exhale it. So God took a breath, or let's say a part of Him, something that was inside of Him, so to speak, and exhaled it, but it went into man. So at once, in one verse, God creates man with this dual nature. He's got a physicality that represents itself in the real world. You can touch it, feel it. It hurts, it cries, it loves. And it has a quality that seems to be metaphysical, beyond things that you can observe and touch and feel. And from the very beginning, we have our controversy for tonight. We've got both qualities to ourselves, the things you can't necessarily touch and feel and explain with ease, and the things you can. Yes?
Is
doesn't say a man became a human being. It says a man became a living soul.
I agree. Some might be inclined to say that that's the primary identity of the man. We're not just another one of the animals, because our identity is reflected in that. Like I said, it's voracious. Each one of these verses, with its own nuances, we could study it at great length. But you're right. So I want to suggest that we started out with this tension. We started out with an inclination, a desire to be big, spiritual, metaphysical, connected to things that we can't see or touch, but it's encased in something physical, something that we want to evaluate. I want the doctor to tell me I have this virus and fix it. I don't want him to say, I don't know what's wrong with you. Go daven. Who does? And we want both. And we're not satisfied with either one. We want to conquer this world, get high-level degrees, explain things. But every time we get to that point where we think we know everything, you get that question where you're not sure what's going on, and you say, well, you know, God knows. Because He does. And that's where I think this all goes back to. And starting from the creation of man till modern time, you can see on your sheets, and I'll blow it up in a second, these are two current blogs or websites, what you call them. One called Kabbalah Online, the other called Rationalist Judaism. These are websites that are going on right now, updated this past week. First one, Rationalist Judaism, exploring the legacy of the rationalist medieval Torah scholars and various other notes. Somebody in this committee is related to this man. He's spoken around the country. He's advancing rationalist perspectives on Judaism. He teaches at an Orthodox yeshivot that some of our teens go to. And right alongside it on the internet, you can find Kabbalah Online. Kosher Kabbalah from the holy city of Safed, or Safed, Israel. Now, they throw in kosher because there's a lot of not kosher Kabbalah. We're not talking about that tonight. But if it's kosher, still. And these are two different approaches. So much so that if I would have given one of these questions to one of my students for an assignment, and they went the only place they know how to research, which is the internet, they would either go to one of these sites and get one type of answer, or the other and get another one. This is today. This is now. And it's real. So we've got a real treat tonight. Probably not enough time to do it justice. But we have an opportunity to start to discuss something that started with the very creation of man, and that, of course, because I think it's built into our nature, carries on through history. And my goals for this evening are twofold. The first, to identify and describe the difference of opinion between Kabbalists and rationalists in their historical context. This is a historical type of course. We want to understand what was happening, when it happened. So, when you leave tonight, you should be able to say a little bit about where this all came from. Now, I gave you a pasuk already in the Torah, but what happened historically that allowed for these camps to exist and what they are about. You should be able to do that. We'll spend the first half of the rest of the time we have together doing that. And the second part for this evening is to apply our understanding of these two camps to things that happen in our life. And you've seen some of these questions are very relevant. We're going to do a little bit more practice applying them. Any questions so far? All right. Excellent. So these are our two goals. If for whatever reason the bell rings and I haven't done them, you tell my wife I didn't do my job and she shouldn't have let me come tonight. But my hope is that I'll be able to give you a little bit of an insight into each one of these so that when you're done, you'll be able to describe these two things. You'll be able to speak to somebody on your way out of this room and explain some of the historical nature and context for Kabbalists and Rationalists, then you'll be able to say, and this is how it makes a difference. And we'll see where we go. First, you've studied the Maimonidean controversy already, correct? Anybody remember anything about that? On the other side of the holidays, maybe? What happened in the Maimonidean controversy? It was a controversy. It involved Maimonides. What else? Okay, so Maimonides, a phenomenal individual, Moshe ben Maimon, living in 12th century and 13th century Spain, the parts of Spain ruled by the Muslims, towards the end of that beautiful period, some call it the Golden Age, before he had to flee the Almohads and go to, ultimately, Egypt, though he had a chance to visit in Israel. This is a picture of his gravesite in Israel. If you want to go visit it, right in there, under that pretty, I don't know what it's called, latticework, I guess, is where he's buried. He wrote a number of fantastic works, starting with his commentary in Arabic on the entire Mishnah, which he wrote as a teenager of about 19, I think, on camelback. Then he wrote a fantastic code of all of the oral law called the Mishnah Torah. We've heard that. Some refer to it as Yad HaChazakah. Some people who didn't like the name Mishnah Torah call it the Yad HaChazakah. Tells you there's a little of a controversy there. And he also wrote a philosophical letter, among other things, to one of his students named Yosef, called Guides to Perplex, Mor Nevuchim, where he explains a lot about the what and the whys of Judaism, obviously in his own terminology. Actually, as a very young child, he started writing about definitions and concepts in Judaism and philosophy. He was very influenced by whom? Aristotle and Greek philosophers. Now, to say influenced, I don't like to use those terms about rabbis because I tend to respect them a great deal. But there's no question that his philosophy had a lot of similarities, and certainly he was very familiar with the philosophy of Aristotle. Good. Anybody remember now why there was a controversy? People didn't... Yes?
Because you're using rationalism and asking questions for something that has been divinely given.
Excellent. So he applied a system explaining and providing perspective on Torah Judaism that he believed you could be arrived at with logic and with the mind. Remember my first question, where does true knowledge come from? Does it come from us? Obviously, not in both camps respect God and his role in the world, but in other words, where can we prove and develop true ideas? So there was a big fight. People didn't like some of the Rambam's work. It was really towards the end of his life, and it took off after he died. You've studied this at great length. Some of the major issues, though, that people disagree about with him were the physical revival of the dead. Some said he didn't emphasize that enough in his writings, that he believed it as a true tenet of Judaism. Others said he wasn't clear about his position of life after death, and if he was, they didn't particularly like it. Another, what he thought was going to happen in the world to come. He writes about it in his writings, and people didn't necessarily like his position. And the reason for mitzvah performance. In the Mor Nevuchim, the Guide to Perplex, he goes at great length explaining all mitzvot. Not just the ones where it's obvious in the Torah what the reason is, but he explains all of them. Obviously to the best of his ability. And like it or not, we're better for it. It's opened up phenomenal discussions. It's given us opportunities to understand more and more about God's Torah. And there's no question a man of his stature, so close and so thoroughly familiar with God's Torah, should have a say in explaining these mitzvot. But it didn't go very well. And what happened ultimately? What's that? Books are burned. Ultimately, even books of the Talmud, volumes of the Talmud were burned. And my question to you, though, is knowing that controversy, who won? How do we know?
We're still reading it happening.
There you go. Yes?
He won because everybody points to their own.
Yeah. That's true, and it's true in his own time. A lot of people read their philosophy into what he said. And you're going to have camps who say that he really did know mysticism, and it's evident in his writings also. My personal opinion is that when you write about God's Torah, you're all ultimately going to end up with very similar ideas, because it's God's Torah. And if you're focused on the truth, you're giving your life to the truth, and only the search for truth, you can use the terminology or that terminology, but you're talking about God's Torah. and God is one, and the Torah is one. But there are those who think absolutely not. And they would say, I'm crazy. So we know the Rambam must have won, because you can find his volumes in every Torah study hall across the world. And we know he won because we've successfully burnt and not used ever again books in Jewish history. It's just the reality. Whether I like it or not, we've successfully don't have books as part of our tradition. But because this took place, and until everything is hammered out, there was skepticism about philosophy. And in the centuries following this controversy, people didn't necessarily want to study philosophy. Maybe they thought it was wrong. Maybe there were letters saying any true Torah student shouldn't study philosophy. And that left a gap. Well, then how else do I explain my existence? Why else am I here if I can't use Aristotelian philosophy? Why else do I perform mitzvot if I'm not going to use the Guide to the Perplexed? The questions still exist. The crisis of existence, of trying to figure out why I'm here, why I'm suffering, why the Jews are in exile, when the Messiah is coming, what should I do in my predicament? They all still exist. So what do you do if you don't have philosophy? So Rabbi Wein, who I believe you all mostly had a chance to hear from, made a reputation for presenting this material across the world, wants to suggest that's exactly why Kabbalah exploded. Kabbalah was around for hundreds of years beforehand. Certainly those believe it goes right back to Har Sinai. And Kabbalah existed, as it's described in the Talmud, as something you don't teach in public, and something that's only discussed high-level teacher to high-level appropriate student. So why does it explode around our period, 1200s, 1300s, and beyond? So I took this in Rabbi Wein's big blue book, Herald of Destiny, which deals with this time period. And as many of you may have read already, he said, because of the attack, and until things could be worked out, Kabbalistic mysticism became a substitute for a lot of the study of philosophy. Further, he says, an open battle about the role of Kabbalah was going to go on for centuries, and there always going to exist a tension between philosophy and Kabbalah, which is why we're here this evening, to study that tension. But if we want to point to a context or historical occurrence that motivated people who normally taught Kabbalah in private to only a small circle of deserving students to teach it publicly and to spread it out and to encourage other people who maybe not had mastered everything to prepare themselves to appreciate the study of Kabbalah and mysticism, maybe this is the reason. And there's no question that at this point in Jewish history, which is our topic for this evening, rationalists versus mystics in the 1500s to 1700s, that we can point to disapproval of philosophy as a reason why maybe it became public. Now, in my personal studies, I like people who have written on everything. I feel more comfortable with them. I'm a big fan of the Ramban, as many of our Nachmanides, because he writes on everything. He writes halakhic works. He writes a commentary on the Torah. He deals with mysticism. He was consulted about the Rambam's philosophical writings and is largely looked upon as somebody who calmed everybody down and said there's a place for everything. And I like people like that. I've sought rabbis in my own lifetime who I feel have mastered the broad range of Jewish scholarship because I feel comfortable with them. They've seen mysticism. They've seen rationalism. And in many ways, I think all of us who said both to many of those questions would probably feel comfortable with the same experience. But from this point on, this is the reality. Some people are in the rationalist camp. Some people are in the mystic camp. Of course, as usual, you have extremes in one direction, and you have extremes in the other direction. And we're going to look at what resulted from this behavior, which personalities lined up on which camp, to get a fuller picture of the historical context before we apply it to our lives.
I was just wondering about the Ashkenazi party piece of this, or if that is totally irrelevant to how this played out.
That's an excellent question. There already was a session about Ashkenazi and Sephardim, correct? It's interesting to see that it really cut across the board. You can do a nice little study about how and when it got into each country. And again, not that the ideas weren't there, but that they became public and part of the average person's experience. But it's everywhere. It's in Ashkenaz, which let's say we'll represent it with Germany. It's in Italy. It's in France. It's in Spain. It's in Israel. It's making the rounds. And I can also point to personalities historically, whether it's Rav Haigon in Bavel before really Ashkenazim and Sparta fully developed, who are commenting on Kabbalistic literature, to people more modern in other areas. So it's Polish, it's German, it's Hasidic, it's not, you know. So it seems to cut across. But this is where we're at. So it's time. We've got a little bit of the historical context. Who are these people? What made them tick? What are their defining features? So let's discuss a few of them. Rationalists. We'll make our first comment about knowledge. It's a little bit wordy. I apologize. Rationalists believe that knowledge is legitimately obtained by man via his reasoning and senses, and should preferably be based upon evidence or reason rather than faith, especially for far-fetched claims like dragons and ghosts and sicknesses that we can't describe. Rationalists will say, prove it to me. Observe it. Quantify it. What is it about? I want to feel it. I want to smell it. I want to taste it. That's when it comes to knowledge. The idea of the scientific process sounds familiar. And it's just funny because that may have put most of Aristotle's ideas out of business, but it sounds like it's up his alley anyway. When it comes to explaining history, rationalists value a naturalistic rather than supernatural interpretation of events. They think things are because of nature, past, present, and future. And they tend to minimize miracles and supernatural things that took place. We'll get to mystics in a second. But again, this kind of flows from the first one. If I talk about a historical event, I think about the rules of nature, society, politics, economics, things that make history take place, and I explain it that way. And finally, when it comes to mitzvot, rationalists understand the purpose of mitzvot and one's religious life in general, primarily or solely, because you see that not everybody wants to be on one extreme, as furthering intellectual moral goals for the individual and society, making a better world, representing God in perfecting this world. Yes? Excellent. Excellent. The question was, how do rationalists explain the 10 plagues? So first and foremost, I would say they minimize it, meaning only when it's absolutely clear in the Torah that something supernatural took place, they'll say, okay, Torah says so. They believe in the Torah, believe in God. But when it doesn't, and you can interpret it one way or the other, they'll go for the most rational position. So for example, there's a midrash that says that it was really one gigantic frog that crawled out of the Nile. Your kids may have come home from school talking about this. And it had a bunch of other frogs jump out from it, from its mouth. Or it was hit a lot of times, and every time they hit it, it turned into more frogs. Now, incidentally, there's a frog that swallows its own eggs and then hatches them from its mouth. And you can watch it on YouTube. But that's not what we're talking about. There's a midrash that says that. Take it or leave it. It's a midrash. But there's another perspective that says a lot of frogs came. And not to say that it would have happened anyway, which I think would be denying what the Torah says, but look at the most limited miracle that would have taken place. Just enough for God to get it to achieve his goals. Because God generally submits himself to the rules of nature. And nature to the best of our ability. And more than that, when you talk about the miracles, do I need to know how they happened? A mystic might say, no, God made it happen. He's God. He can do it again. And a rationalist might say, I want to understand how it happened. Is there are there the tools that we have in science to understand how this reality could have taken place? And then I can at least say, God just pushed that button. And this chemical reacted with this and produced that, and you got it. But I appreciate the question even more so because when we get to our application, the study of Torah is going to be the center of this. How do I read things in the Torah? If I'm a rationalist, it's one way. If I'm a mystic, it's another. So, any other questions about rationalists?
How do you define moral when you're talking about all this rationalism? What makes moral and morality rationalist?
I hear you. I think that you're going to have to be stuck with what works best for society. In other words, not moral in an objective sense, because that study is going to say there's only so objective I can be. But it's clear to me that protecting little kids is a good thing to do, not apart from what the Torah tells me. So I'm going to say that mitzvot are there to help me become a sensitive person because I see that that's what's important. But again, you're right. You're right. It's going to be a very limited. It's not going to be a very abstract term. Yeah, I agree. And in its extreme form, I think it feels that way. And some, instead of feeling the warmth and cuddliness of God's open miracle hand, will feel more like it appeals to them maybe more because it makes sense. And that's maybe they gravitate towards that. And not because it's the best explanation or because it allows for a very meaningful life. Not meaningful, but fun or a positive experience. Meaning to say, yeah, if the only thing I'm supposed to do when I'm sick is consult with medicine, that's a yucky feeling. You can't express yourself emotionally and turn to God and say, yeah, I need a miracle here. And I've witnessed people like that in Queens who they won't say to Hillel if someone's sick. And one of the things that I don't expect to have an answer for is that simply because these great debates took place and balanced each other out and we have the benefit of standing on their shoulders and, you know, creating a lifestyle for us? Or are we kind of bending the rules? And they are kind of mutually exclusive. And we'll see if we can find some cases that really split. But I would tend to agree with you. Like I said, in my own experience, that's the way I live my life. I would say we have everything. Within the Jewish observant camp, within an Orthodox camp, you'll get an extreme version, but like you said, you won't cross that line. So you'll say, yeah, I believe in the Torah. It's my tradition. I believe it's accurate. But my whole approach to the Torah is going to be in that context. And of course, there's people who cross that line, which is why they had the whole Maimonidean controversy. People were saying, we don't go that far, and that you're leading or opening the door for people to just step over that line. Not so much because he was so crazy. Obviously, in context, they may have been crazy, but not because of the ideas themselves, but yeah, there were people who were starting to live a lifestyle where they didn't perform mitzvot. They didn't feel they had to. And they maybe said things about God that maybe the Rambam wouldn't have said. And so I think that's why you had the fight. But within Orthodoxy, a lot of people will say, like you said, preferably, of course, we recognize the Torah, we recognize our tradition, but my whole approach to interpreting it and to living it is going to be in that context. Kabbalists. I tried to line it up on the same topic. Kabbalists are skeptical of the ability of the human mind to arrive at truth. They prefer to base knowledge on revelation, or for those who are not worthy of revelation, on faith in those who do experience revelation. This is distilled. This is very extreme sounding. But there's components of it that we can observe, and that's their perspective. That's where it really comes from. Second, when it comes to history and events, Kabbalists prefer miracles and believe them to be especially dominant in ancient history and the future messianic era. Some have argued about the whole prefer thing. there's a lot of Kabbalists who don't expect miracles every day when they wake up. Like their glass of water is going to miraculously be filled from the sky. So you can parenthesize prefer, but they acknowledge it, possibly welcome miracles, and they tend to maximize the number of supernatural things going on in the world. They talk about angels. You might hear a person say, each time you do a mitzvah, it creates an angel. You might hear somebody say, that was the hand of God, a lot, as opposed to saying that was the normal course of events or through other channels. And finally, when it comes to mitzvos, they see mitzvos as primarily performing mechanistic manipulations of spiritual forces, with their reasons being either to accomplish this or ultimately incomprehensible. God said I should do it, so I'm going to do it. Some mitzvot, I can't tell you why I'm going to do it, but I know for sure God told me to. You want to give me a reason? Maybe I care, maybe I don't. And even if it's a good one, I might still go to sleep at night saying I did this because God told me to. And He's got good enough reasons for me. Also sounds a little bit of like some things that we live with. Sounds a lot more like what my kids experience in kindergarten, though. I'll tell you that much. It's all about miracles. It's all about, you know, building that relationship with God. And it's very different from the rationalist way. The Rambam writes that there's degrees of revelation. The primary one being Moses, with what we call Aspaklari HaMe'ira, clear interpretation and conversation with God. And then there are other prophets that come in somewhere along the leaderboard in terms of their clarity. And on the lower rungs, you get these ideas of divine inspiration, where your closeness to God, your complete involvement in His world, can earn you divine inspiration. Some would say there's a constant radio signal. You just don't have the receiver. You get the receiver, you can hear what's going on. So I think that's more what we're talking about. I don't think any modern-day Kabbalist will say to you he's a prophet like Moses. But you'll read in the writings of the Vilna Gaon, certainly a mystic, living in the 1700s, that he was visited by angels, and he turned them down. You'll read in the writings of Rav Moshe Chaim Luzzatto in Italy, same period. This is something Shlomo HaMelech told me when he visited me. Abraham told me this interpretation. He means it. His students believed him. I still study his books. So you have differences. You have others who will say, no, that's not happening. I have an intellect. I've got everything I need to grow and to learn. What we didn't touch to very much is where this all came from. We talked about exploding. We didn't talk much about where it came from. A Kabbalist will tell you, and I don't mean a Kabbalist like to the exclusion of us, and I don't mean a rationalist, but I mean a pure mystic explaining mysticism will tell you, these are the part and parcel of the Torah that was given to Moshe at Har Sinai, possibly revealed to others earlier. And it's part of our old Torah. And the same way we have Mishnah, which we studied last year, Talmud, you have Zohar, and it's from the same rabbinic period, written by the same individuals. And they will say, yeah, this is the deeper meaning. A rationalist, again, there's degrees. You can be on a, I would say, a pretty far extreme and be very minimal in which volumes of Kabbalah you'll be willing to accept. And you might attribute them to great scholars who had perspective in Torah and Judaism, but you might not welcome them as, like you said, the final word. And since these ideas are not explicit in the Torah, like the world to come, the revival of the dead, and some of those things, there's room for debate. And in the end, the Rambam's, who better than the Rambam's words to say, why don't we just let it happen and see? You know, I can only go so far. But yeah, you're right, completely. That's why this is a controversy, because some will say, I totally disagree with you. Let's look at some rationalists. Rambam, I'm blocking it, I apologize. Rambam. Ralbag, have we heard of Ralbag before? Famous for his commentary on the Torah, but he also wrote a philosophical work called Melchemet Hashem, Levi ben Gershon. You see, he's a little bit later than the Rambam. And we've got Rivash, a little bit later. It's funny for me because in my yeshiva world, my studies of the Rivash have nothing to do with philosophy. Mm-hmm. He wrote some phenomenal halakhic works. He's quoted by the Shulchan Aruch. He was a first-rate halachic scholar, and we accept his position to this day. So I'm saying that because these people are in our camp, but they're rationalists. Chasdai ben Yehuda Kraskas, there's a whole family with that last name. He wrote a fantastic philosophical work. I don't know him to be a Talmudist. And Rav Yosef Albo, has anybody heard of the volume Sefer HaIkarim? I studied that for one of the years I was in yeshiva. It's a two-volume philosophical work. He's also, you might recognize his name, he's also very famous because he was the subject of one of those famous disputes between a Catholic Christians and the Jews, and he was forced to debate Judaism and defend it. And finally, Isaac ben Yehuda Abravanel. Anybody know the Shlok Rock song, Abravanel? So he's, a wonderful personality, a great defender of the Jewish people, a scholar who wrote a commentary on Tanakh, and, of course, a philosopher. All these people have volumes studied in our Beit Midrash, have almost all of them I know of individual halachic positions that we accept, but they're in the rationalist camp. Well, you're doomed to failure when you're not the king. So I think I studied the one of the Ramban more than Rav Albo. I think he made good arguments. I don't know if it made much of a difference in history. But I think there's a dramatization of it. On the other team, we've got Ramban, Moshe ben Nachman. Look at the dates. He was a little child, 10 years old it looks like, if these dates are accurate, when the Ramban passed away. So he was consulted in the controversy that ensued, but didn't exactly meet him. And he, now again, remember, the Ramban was in part of Spain that was ruled by Islam and eventually left. Ramban was in the part of Spain ruled by Christians and eventually left. But it wasn't exactly the same neighborhood. And the Ramban eventually went to Israel and set up shop there. Next, we've got Bachya ben Asher. Have you heard of the parish on the Torah called Rabbeinu Bachaya? Some people pronounce it that way. Some look at his commentary when they have difficulty with the Ramban. What the Ramban did that's so remarkable is that in his commentary on the Torah, he read a verse and he said, this is what it seems to me according to Rashi. This is what I think the pshat is. The clear meaning of the verse. This is what the Midrash says. And this is what Kabbalah says. And then he published a book and everybody read it.
So he was all of the above.
Yeah. So some would say he's all of the above. Some put him in the mystical camp, though, because he clearly, in his writings, is more of a proponent and more involved in that camp. But when you write a commentary on the Torah in the year 1200, and you explain verses in the Torah based on Kabbalah, you're publicizing Kabbalah. It's your fault. It's out there now. And many times he wrote, anybody who understands will understand what I just said. And that's when I didn't understand what he was talking about. Sometimes he'll write, I can't write any more about this, but people who know, know. But the fact is, he wrote a commentary for the masses and incorporated Kabbalah into his writings. And that was a remarkable thing historically. We've heard of the Ari? Yes. His teacher in Kabbalah he learned from a guy named Rabbi Ovadia. Rabbi Ovadia and he was a student, and there were two students, Rav Avadia and Rav Ezra, who were students of the Ravid, Rav Avram ben David, who was a big Kabbalist. One of them was blind, so he's known in the Aramaic as Tagi Nahor, which means full of light, and it's a euphemism for not being able to see. And he cites them primarily as his teachers. In halacha, in legal writings, he started a whole school. I mean, everybody in Spain, the rule is, they all go like the Ramban. So he started a school, but of course he had halachic leaders that he followed, like, in Spain, those names aren't readily familiar to us. Then we've got the Ari. He blew up Kabbalah in terms of developing a clear way of explaining it, publicizing it even greater. He's living in Israel. He's obviously a little bit later. We call it Lurianic Kabbalah because of him. And much of what Kabbalah has been going on since then is within his school. So the Vilna Gaon, a couple hundred years later, is clarifying and conceptualizing Lurianic Kabbalah. The Hasidim, starting with the Baal HaTanya, starting with the Baal Shem Tov, they're talking about Lurianic Kabbalah, all going back to the Ari. We've got Yosef Karo. Heard of him? Author of the Shulchan Aruch. He's in the Ari's court. He has a volume of Torah interpretations that's exclusively based on his conversations with angels. You can read it. It's online. It's called Magid Meisharim. And it's a compilation of the interpretations of the Torah that he experienced with angels. This is a Kabbalist. He wrote our Shulchan Aruch. Maybe that's why we're all so confused. Maybe that's why we're all... because our tradition blends these two. But you can imagine that was the case. There's actually a fantastic record written by some people in the school of the Ari about the night they were visited by an angel for the first time. And the angel gave them some instructions about what to do so it will happen again. You can read it. I think a version of it appears in the Kola. The Maharal, heard of him. Rabbi Freundlich is fond of quoting him recently. He is another systemizer of Kabbalah. He's somebody who's coming after, really after Aristotelian philosophy and certainly mathematics and science was kind of being pushed away. And he wrote a commentary on almost all the Jewish experience dealing with, influenced by Kabbalah. Okay. I don't know. How are we doing on time? Do we have a... How many?
24.
Okay. Well, I'm trying to squeeze as much as I can in, but let's get to the fun. We said goal number one was historical context, defining. So what was the historical context that allowed for this debate? Who remembers? We talked about the Maimonidean controversy, the fact that philosophy was suspect, and we talked about Rabbi Wein saying maybe that's what opened up the space for people to explain their life and their experience with Kabbalah. We talked about that as a historical context. We defined rationalism, and we defined Kabbalism. Again, we took one definition. I appreciate the other definition. You can continue your studies and look for the best explanation that you have. So we discussed the historical context, we defined the two camps, and we looked at some famous figures, all whom we study until this day, who represent those camps. Now it's game time. This is our life. You're teaching Torah around your Shabbos table. Then you read of this fantastic story in Parshas Vayera. And Abraham is sitting outside his tent. And it's a hot day because he just had a bris milah at the ripe old age of, yes. And God, the Torah says, brought out a very hot day. Rashi says he took the sun out of its case so that he wouldn't have any guests, because God knew what? When those guests show up, he's going to bring them into his tent. But then God has mercy on him, the Torah says, and he sends him three people who appear to him as passers-by, but you all know? How do you know they're angels? Okay. And, of course, he welcomes them into his home. Application number one of Kabbalism versus rationalism talks about how you can interpret cases like this. Are you going to read this as some mystical experience? Or are you going to try to explain it the best way your brain knows how? And you don't see angels every day, dressed like Arabs. The Rambam says that was all a vision. It's on the books. I didn't make it up. He says that episode in the Torah was something Avraham watched. Didn't get out of his seat, which is kind of nice, given what he was going through. God didn't make him get out of his seat. He watched it happen. He watched three angels in a vision appear. And he watched himself greet them the way only he could. That's the Rambam's interpretation of that verse. Now you know why some people wanted to burn his books. It says in the Torah it happened. You told me it didn't happen? That makes some people upset. The Ramban, and I cited his commentary. I actually have it here. You can read it. I have the Hebrew version. You can read the English version downstairs. The Ramban says, I don't know why he said that. This absolutely happened. The Torah says it happened. And when the Torah says it happened, it happened. It was a miracle. God made three angels show up, appear as human, appear to eat as human, appear supernatural. It happened. Who's on the Rambam side? Don't be embarrassed, he's a Rambam. Who's on the Ramban side? Yeah, my kids are on the Ramban side also. You want to know why the Ramban appeals to a lot of people? For the following reason. The Rambam doesn't limit this to this episode. He says there's other episodes in the Torah that didn't actually happen. Jacob's fight with that angel. The Torah says Jacob was left alone and he fought with an ish. Vayevateri Yaakov levado Vayeavek ish imo. It's a song we used to sing in yeshiva. Adalos ha-shachar. Until sunrise. Rambam says, I don't know why he doesn't just say he fought with a real man. He says that was a vision. One problem. Why don't we eat the sciatic nerve? Because he got hurt there in a dream. So the Ramban says, how could you explain that? How do you limp away from a dream? Unless you watch The Matrix. I'm saying it's not something that's readily understandable. So the Ramban says, of course this happened. And that's why we have this mitzvah. And that's why he limped away. But the Rambam says no. And again, I'm not one to argue with the Rambam. Jewish history hasn't written the Rambam off. These are two schools of thought. And it expresses itself in number one, case number one for tonight, of applying this debate, how you read things in the Torah. And both camps, now we're not going to resolve this issue tonight, but both camps are going to have, or each camp is going to have its own way of reading the verses in the Torah. So now we're trying to achieve our second goal, and we put case number one, reading the Torah, interpreting its events. Case number two, life cycle event. One of the things that Kabbalah did was frame things differently. It put it in a different context. It gave pastoral care a whole new life. Because it's not just, well, that's because you got sick, because your genes. It's because other things. And when it comes to exile, for example, rationalists might say this is an unfortunate consequence of our misbehavior. And even that's a stretch, because that means the hand of God is affecting nature. But they'll say this has happened sometimes. Jews get killed sometimes. We are the unfortunate casualties in World War I. It happens. We were at the wrong place at the wrong time. I know that's a little bit extreme and callous. But they're working within nature. And if you're in the wrong place at the wrong time, and a bomb goes off, you get hurt. That's one extreme. But Kabbalists made a whole different picture of things. They looked at exile as an opportunity. I'll give you an example. I worked in a yeshiva high school in St. Louis that had a girls' building, but no boys' building. Very progressive. And so they had to rent space. I was there 4 years, and we were in three different buildings. Once in a conservative shul, once in a traditional shul, once in a reform shul. So the rabbi used to joke, we're uncovering sparks wherever we go. You know, bringing the word of God wherever we were going. I didn't like his joke very much. I didn't like traveling to a different school every... I can't tell how many times I got in my car tired and went to the wrong place. Because I'm just used to it. Kabbalah turned exile into something else entirely. Spreading out the Jewish people throughout the world to uncover sparks called nitzotzos. to realize spiritual potential that exists in people, in places, and in things throughout the world. Not so much the why, but it framed it differently. And everybody since then, from this school, marched out to make the very best of their exile, to make the very best of their suffering. Why am I suffering? Why do I have this challenge? There's something to uncover here. God wants me here to realize the potential, to find some sanctity and some spark in this part of the world, this part of my body, in this item, in this nation. Maybe this nation has something to give to us, so we live in their land for a little bit before they kick us out. It framed things differently. It's a different perspective. And I mentioned this really as life cycle events. I use exile as an example. Take the same thing with illness. And not just bad stuff. Good stuff are opportunities. You're given the opportunity to do something. And when a rationalist might say you're sick because you have a virus and you can get better by taking antibiotics, a Kabbalist might say, not for a virus. See, what do I know? I'm sorry. You're sick because you have an infection, and you can get better if you take antibiotics. But a rationalist, a mystic, or a Kabbalist might say, you're sick because you've done an Avera, or because you're distant from God. And you'll get better by getting closer to God, by reciting these prayers, by wearing this amulet, by apologizing, by doing a particular mitzvah over and over again. It's a different perspective. Now, I studied with Dr. David Pelkovitz. Did he speak here ever? Anybody recognize that name? Dr. David Pelkovitz. He works at YU. Yes, he worked at NYU. And he does the pastoral counseling and training for rabbinic students at YU. And at the time, I don't know the answer, so I apologize for bringing this up without knowing the answer. But he was doing a study about what people who are suffering like to hear. And he had a couple different options. Do they want to hear other people have this too?
No.
That doesn't help me any. Do they want to hear you're getting this because God knows you can overcome it?
No.
People say, I'd rather not. Whatever. You're getting this because it's going to make you a better person? So he was trying to do a study. I mean, there aren't so many good ways to look at being, you know, ill or suffering. But he was trying to figure out what works. A rationalist might want to hear a simple explanation. Like I said, you're sick and you can get better. Or you're sick and you might not get better. That's part of life. And a mystic might want to say, there is never an end. There's always an opportunity. There's always a chance. And if I've exhausted all medical opportunities, I'm going to find a great rabbi or a spiritual woman who understands God and understands the world, who will bless me or might give me something to eat. And I'll go with that. And everything, it's got to work for you. It doesn't have to work for me. And so no one's going to tell you what works for you. But these are two existent or extant camps, and they look at things differently. And if, like I said, if you're on one extreme, you won't say Tehillim if you're sick. I once heard someone say that. He was proud. I was sitting at his table. I couldn't believe it. He was proud that when his class got up to say Tehillim, his child didn't, because it's not their belief, because they're rationalists. And there's all kinds of weird things with that. I'm not even to get to, it's a weird rationalist. There's all kinds of things wrong with that, because it's a weird thing to train your kids to do. But that was his position. Some people in that camp might not be as concerned with ayin haras. These things express themselves that way. And others will say Tehillim and deprive themselves of all kinds of things and travel the world to try to connect with any aspect of their spirituality to address their circumstances. And one other example I wanted to point out was the end of days, which hopefully we will see in a positive way. The Rambam talks about details of the end of days as allegory. Do you know that famous phrase? Who's been to the restaurant Wolf and Lamb in New York City? Anybody? Yeah, it's good. It's not bad. I dated my wife there a couple times. It's right near Rockefeller Center. Go ice skating. Go out to eat. So where does the concept of wolf and lamb come from? Yeah, it's a vision of the future where these two animals will get along. It would ruin all kinds of childhood fairy tales about wolves and lambs getting together. But that's the vision. So, is that really going to happen? Rambam says no. We're talking about those characteristics. Or maybe it's referring to nations who are antagonistic towards each other. We're talking about concepts. Others, I put down the Ramban because I know he says it, that's actually going to happen. Nature's going to change. And these animals that normally eat each other for dinner are going to play together. Again, we're not here to resolve this issue other than bringing Mashiach and finding out for ourselves. But these are two different perspectives on what's in store for us. Do the rules that God set in motion with nature stay that way? And do they just define our experience or not? Gan Eden is a perfect example. If I'm not mistaken, the Ramban writes that Gan Eden exists on this planet. You can go there. Who knows if that takes him out of his mystical camp, or maybe that's an expression of it. Others will say Gan Eden is not a place you feel with your body, with food, and with whatever you imagine Gan Eden is supposed to be like. But there's something that you experience with your spirit and your personality, and something that exists beyond the real world. These are just some examples. And they extend to a wide range of the human experience that split these camps. Now, I said I wasn't going to resolve this issue. I don't know if there's a need. But what I hope we've come away with is understanding a little bit about maybe where we stand, but understanding something that developed in history that influences us to this very day, knowing that there are camps of Jewish people, good, God-fearing, observant people who identify with one perspective and others who express with others. And what I learned when I was preparing this is how much I straddle the fence with a lot of what I do. There was a long-standing tradition in Chazal that mysticism was to be studied privately from an experienced, trained teacher who received a tradition from his teacher to an experienced student who had shown their abilities. And one of the ways they qualified that was by reaching the age of 40. To put it in perspective, Rav Moshe Chaim Lutzado, the Ramchal, died when he was 40. And people are blown away by the fact that he had so desired to openly study Kabbalah and so to speak, missed his chance. The way that's referred to in the Talmud is two ways. The body of literature is either called Maaseh Merkava, the descriptions of the holy chariot, the throne of God, or Maaseh Bereishis, the description of creation. And if you look through Chazal, you'll find that these areas, and that's explicit in the Talmud, should be studied only from an experienced teacher to a student who's ready. And we've typically referred to that as by reaching the age of 40. And I think it's more along the lines of when you're ready. But historically, a lot of the controversies have developed when people under those ages, or in more public forums than have been traditionally appropriate, got involved. So Ramchal got his books burned or buried because he was doing it at the age of 20. And had he waited to 40, others, I think, would have backed off. But I think in periods of history where it was less concerning because of controversies and because of Shabtai Tzvin and because of all those issues, I don't know if it was in a particular age moment as much as it was you knew when your student was ready, and even then you only did it in private anyway. But there's no question that's the case. And I would like to add to your point. There's a fantastic rabbi named Rabbi Yaakov Hillel. Has anybody heard of that name? Living in Israel, he runs the yeshiva of Mikubalim, studying Kabbalah. I had the chance to meet him not too long ago, and I was excited about it, because he's really a phenomenal, contemporary, approachable person who's got his head, so to speak, in the clouds and studying Kabbalah. And some of the great rabbis in Israel approached him to write a book explaining Kabbalah simply because it was becoming so popular, let's say in Los Angeles, and from with celebrities. And I have to be honest with you, Kabbalah works. That's our tradition. If you ask the average Orthodox rabbi, they're not going to write off Kabbalah. It's real. It's part of our tradition. And there's a difference between, now again, you can have your position on what it does, how it works, but it's part of our Jewish tradition. And the average Orthodox rabbi is going to say it's there. And there's a difference between what's being taught on the street to make a lot of money and to appeal to celebrities who want to tap into something ancient and true, and the way that we've traditionally related to this. And so therefore they approached him. He wrote a fantastic book. It's called Faith and Folly. You can read it in English, where he talks about the basic concepts, but it was more towards that end. And I would say, if this is the only time Kabbalah comes up in this series, I'll say it now, that I think that there's a lot of good reason for that tradition. In my own studies, I'm 34, so 6 years at now. In my own studies, the systems and the terminology and the simple background to comprehend these texts is vast and requires a great deal of study. I can tell you from my own experience, whenever I've had to pick up or come across a passage of Kabbalah. And so certainly the popular Kabbalah that you see, and people who have websites that aren't backed by large organizations of long-standing tradition, I would avoid using them to characterize anything about our true tradition. Much the same way I would say that about Kashrus or anything else about Judaism. But something that this controversy addressed was that it's a point in history when Kabbalah became big. It came out of the inner sanctum of the Jewish tradition. And what we, as educated people who clearly dedicate your time to study of true study of Torah Judaism, when we take ourselves seriously, we need to be discerning at which sources and who we trust to clarify and discuss these matters. I believe I probably am just about towards the end, so I want to say a couple last things. First and foremost, remember those three announcements I said? No class next week. January 27th is Rabbi Freundlich on failed messiahs. And you can participate in the raffle, whether you have or haven't already. And number two, thank you so much. My preparation for this class, what I look forward to in spending time with you, I feel like I did way too much talking, so I apologize if you're sick of my voice. But I've enjoyed very much the chance to talk about these ideas with you, and to hopefully begin your interest in another fascinating part of our Jewish tradition. And I look forward to many more opportunities. So yashar koach to all of you. Have a great night.
For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. He does not make money off the site, but he does need money in order to run the site. Those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.